This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about the publishing industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today, I'm talking to Merrill Leffler. He's the founder and publisher of Dryad, a press, and also originally the co-founder of Dryad as a magazine with Neil Lerman. And that was, I believe, and you can correct me, Merrill, but I think it was 1968 that your first issue appeared?
That was the first issue.
So it is 2016 as we speak, so that was nearly a half a century ago. doesn't time flies, I guess you could say.
Oh, gosh.
But maybe you could just go back a little bit to the beginning, you know, and I know at when you first started, you were an engineer, you were at NASA, and you know, just maybe you could talk a little bit about how you got from being an engineer to being a literary publisher.
Well, there's no logical explanation for this, I have to tell you. When I came to Washington, I worked at Goddard Space Flight Center, and a friend, but not a very close friend at all, who I met in North Carolina through my cousin. I was at North Carolina State College at that time, it was called, and my cousin was at the University of North Carolina, and he had met Neil Lerman, and I occasionally would go back with my cousin. We'd meet back in High Point where his family was, and Howard brought Neil there to have a home-cooked meal. And that's where we met, and you know, we didn't have all that much to say to each other. He was doing a degree in accounting and became a CPA rather quickly after he graduated. And then when I came up to Washington, I came to work at NASA, as you said, and but I had a... If I say I had a literary interest, I had really been unhappy in what I was doing before I got to Goddard. I worked at a Langley Research Center first, and I always thought of myself as writing prose. I think I came to Thomas Wolfe quite early, at the right time when I was 18. But I just wasn't writing stories or couldn't complete them. But I found myself writing poems. Of course, the poems were coming out of the experience, the literary experience I had, which is rather limited. I had very few literary courses. I never took poetry in and of itself. And I was really writing poems out of just feeling a certain kind of despair. You know, the critic John Bailey said that poets write to cheer themselves up. And if they're lucky, if the poem is good enough, it'll cheer someone else up. Well, I was trying to cheer myself up, I think. The short story is that Neil got in touch with me because we had met there. And it turned out he was the only one I knew who was interested in poetry. There wasn't that much going on here in Washington or that we knew of. So we would speak about poetry. He would show me his poems. I would show him mine. But we didn't know anybody. We had no literary connections. And for some reason, what that leap was when we said, we should do a poetry magazine. We were getting some literary magazines, little magazines.
So you knew about other magazines, in other words.
Oh, I knew. I had seen small magazines. Yeah. And I knew nothing about publishing. I mean, nothing. And originally we thought about using, his uncle was a CPA, and in the basement they had a mimeograph machine, and we thought, well, why don't we, we could put out a magazine using a mimeograph machine. Well, that soon went by the boards, and I found myself getting very interested in all of this about paste up, so where did we get poems? We advertised for poems. I just remember this very clearly, the New Republic and the New York Review of Books had just started up. And so we advertised for poems, and poems, here and there would come in. And for me, this was a kind of literary apprenticeship. I was writing back to everybody. I'd hate to see some of the letters I wrote back. I kept them all, and they were all at the University of Maryland archives with all this Dryad magazine and books, correspondence and all of that material. But it was a way of me trying to find a language. And then I started taking classes at night in literature. I actually left NASA because I was traveling so much. I was involved in rocketry. I needed to find a job so I could go to school at night at the University of Maryland. And with the one plan I had in my life, and that was that if I liked it, and if I could do it, I was going to quit engineering and go to graduate school in literature. Not to become a poet. I felt my education was just so slender. I wanted to be a writer. I had this ideal of being a writer, and again, I'm not talking about poetry to go to, but more to make my living as a writer.
Were you thinking at that time in terms of being part of a literary tradition, or was this still kind of self-motivated at that point?
It was really self-motivated, although I can tell you, I really got very far into doing the magazine. I learned about, as I said, about Paste Up, but also we started getting poetry, and then from around the country, but then here in Washington, and a poet by the name of Rod Jellema and Linda Paston, whose name you may know, mm-hmm. we published a number of, several issues of poems. And then I wrote to poets, William Stafford, who is one of the sweet men. He was so cognizant. I think it was in the second or third issue. I had written to Bill. I mean, I say Bill, I didn't know him. I just, I read the book Traveling Through the Dark, and I was just knocked out by it. And he sent poems, and he said, and realizing that we were younger people who were just starting out this magazine, feeling that we would feel some obligation, he said, "Now listen," he wrote, "if you don't like these poems, that's okay. Just send them back. I have others." He said, "I depend on editors." So it was very, very thoughtful.
And this was, it was, Stafford was then in, he was in Oregon, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, this was before, before he became the poet laureate.
This is why. And then there was another magazine, really a marvelous journal that started, a man named Bill Clare, William F. Clare, started Voyages. And this was a very classy, more than poetry. He was doing prose. He was featuring poets. And I would meet Bill. He was the head of the SUNY office here in Washington, and he had graduated Columbia and had Mark Van Doren as a teacher. And Mark Van Doren had put him in touch with so many people. And Bill and I would go out to lunch because I was working downtown Washington. And I would just sit and listen to him speak about all these literary people who I was just beginning to read. And we went to, I can't remember what year it was. We drove down together, my wife Anne, Bill and I, to the little, I think it was the first little magazine conference in North Carolina at University of North Carolina. That's when Bill Matthews,
oh, yes.
was getting his PhD, and Russell Banks right. was an undergraduate.
And they were doing Lilla Bolero magazine.
Lilla Bolero, that great, I thought, great magazine. I mean, they were coming out, and I had been applying to graduate schools, and I'd applied to Carolina. And I got in, but without an assistantship. And Bill and Russell were, graduating that year. And when I spoke to the chair of the English department, he said, "Well, if you come here, you could have their office. You can keep Dryad going, and we'll see about an assistantship after you're here." But we were already in Washington, and my wife Anne was working, and going from a full time job to a teaching assistantship at Maryland was taking a cut of about 80% of the salary. So it was easier to stay here. And I was very lucky we did, because as things would go, I went to Maryland during the year and got a fellowship for 3 years and got to go to England for a year, and that turned into 3 years. So it's, there's a Yiddish word called beshert, or faded, who knows? Every step you take, every corner you turn is another life, right?
That's right.
So,
it's impossible to, all of those paths, or those, the decisions made and, things not done are completely unknowable.
Yeah.
Unknowable.
Sure. I mean, that's what you make fiction out of, speculate on what happens. So, we started doing the magazine. Neil and I were very ambitious. He had moved to San Francisco, by the way. So in the early days, we had both a Maryland and a San Francisco address on the magazines. And then when we started doing books, what happened with the magazine is that, of course, as we had published a number of issues, we started getting flooded with with poetry. And when my wife and I went to England in 1969, I had a sister who was working on the Hill, And I had a post office box at the main post office there, and she would gather up manuscripts that came in and sent them to me in England. It was just great. I was really doing the magazine. I mean, Neil was involved strongly, but I put it out from in England, but just one issue a year. And then there was this transition. I came back to the States in the early 70s, 1972, and I didn't have much money. I was an instructor at Maryland, finishing my graduate work, and I couldn't even keep up with the manuscripts, though. And I realized, Neil and I got together about this, that a number of the poets that we were publishing hadn't published books. People like Roland Flint, who went on to become Maryland Poet Laureate. We published his first two books. So we were publishing first books. Myra Sclareau, From the Backyard of the Diaspora, won the National Jewish Book Award for Poetry that year. We published a couple of books of Paul Zimmer's. And a number of first books beyond that, so that was very exciting. And we had some distribution here in Washington, and then it's been up and down. There were different times I thought, okay, I can't do this anymore, but I seem to have I'm going on strongly. I mean, originally it was a poetry press, and I've been doing over these last 15 years or more fiction and some nonfiction. Still coming out with a couple of books a year, no more than two.
So what year was the first book that you published?
Well, the first book was, we issued as an, it was called Something Tugging the Line by Rod Jellema. And, I published it as a book. We published it as a book, but it was an issue of the magazine. And then we did an anthology called A Tumult for John Berryman, edited by Marguerite Harris in New York. If you remember Berryman's,
I remember that book.
Tremendous,
yeah.
Influence.
Yeah.
Not, the 77 Dream Songs and his dream, his toy, his book, his dream. I think that's what it is. Or his book, his toy, his dream. And poets had to get Berryman out of their system. And Marguerite Harris, who was a kind of doyenne in the East Village, started collecting poems. And she must have had 300 poems or 250 or so poems about, memorializing, or not memorializing, but that were poets were writing these Berryman poems so they could get on with it. And we had contacted each other, and I went up to New York to meet with her. And I said, we just couldn't publish all these poems. There was a lot of repetition, of the Henry and Mr. Bones of Berryman's poems. So we wound up doing a modest book of about 80 pages. And that was an issue of the magazine, but I published it as a book. Okay. And then Roland Flint's And Morning, wonderful book of poetry. So yeah, and then Roland, who taught at Georgetown, wonderful teacher, and he did his PhD at Minnesota, and he was a student of James Wright's, and they became friends. And Wright had come down, Jim had come down to Washington to see Roland, and he really loved Roland's book, The Modesty of It. It's a really understated, beautiful little book. And he asked Roland if he thought I would be interested in doing a small chapbook of prose poems of his. And so James Wright was, one of my heroes then, among modern poets, contemporary poets. And we wound up I was able to get a grant, and we did this beautiful book of prose poems called Moments of the Italian Summer with paintings that we had commissioned. We had enough money in the grant to do that. And lovely book. So it's gone on from there to, and Reed Whittemore, it's strange how reputations, as we know, come and go. Reed was very involved literary-wise. He was consultant in poetry at the Library of Congress, but in 1980, and had taught at Carleton for almost 20 years, but came to Maryland. He came to Washington as a consultant, went back to Carleton. This was in 67 or 68, and then came back to Washington. And he became the literary editor of the New Republic, started teaching at Maryland. And in 1980, by the early 80s, though, Reed didn't have any books in print. Oh. And I had met him, and I really cared for his poems. I mean, there's ironic, sometimes comic, but there's also a darker side to that work as well. He had the kiss of death in a way. Tom Gunn had once said, had written that Reed Whittemore is one of the funniest poets in America. And that's the kiss of death, you know, to call a poet funny. But there was another element. And in fact, I had suggested to Reed, offered Reed, that we publish his selected poems, which he was, you know, willing to do, and I was very happy to do. And in fact, I took a line from one of his poems. I don't remember what it was titled originally, but there was a line called The Feel of Rock, which he then changed to the title poem. And the reason I liked that line was because it had that solidity, but also it suggested the feel, because Reed wasn't noted for that, you know, that feeling aspect of his poetry. And, so it became The Feel of Rock, a wonderful, it's 128 page selected and new poems. Every book you make, and you know, you've published, every book is special. But then there are books that are more special. I worked with Reed in doing Against the Grain, The Literary Life of a Poet, which I think is, you know, is a book that I have a great affection for because we worked so closely on it together.
Now, you said you do roughly, I mean, a couple of books a year. Obviously you're... a literary endeavor, but you mentioned that you had gotten grants over the course of time. Is it mostly supported by grants or sales or a combination?
First of all, the grants that we got were early on, you know, in the late 70s. It's Neil, who was a CPA, an accountant, he took care of that. I just had educated myself out of doing that. And we had some NEA grants, and that probably up until the late 70s, maybe 80, 81. No, the money has come from Neil and me. And we sold books. Obviously, you have to sell books. And then I've had these different arrangements. So this would be too long a story, but the short story is that I co-published a number of books, five books, first with Syracuse University Press. I had met Robert Mandel through the mails, and I had the money to publish an anthology called After the First Rain, Israeli Poems on War and Peace. And we had gotten the money to do that through Moshe Dor, an Israeli poet, who was in touch with Shimon Peres, who wrote the foreword, you know, substantial foreword to the book. And through a foundation in Australia, believe it or not, we got the money. And I built enough money in there that we were going to deliver 1,000 books to Australia to do an American edition. And I didn't have any distribution at the time because I was publishing so irregularly. There were some years I didn't publish any books. And I went looking for another publisher as a co-publisher. They wouldn't have to put up any money. We would take care of it all. We had the plates.
So right, they would just essentially act as a publisher of convenience, you might call it.
Exactly. And I had some interest, but the one that came through was Syracuse, and Robert Mandel was the director. And so we co-published the book. And then a manuscript came my way that by Joyce Kornblatt, who published several books, three books with commercial houses. And I've long known Joyce, and she had a wonderful book, a novel. And while Syracuse had not published original novels, Robert had started a quality paperback series of Jewish American writers whose books were out of print. This included Cynthia Ozick and a number of well-known writers. And I sent Robert this manuscript, which is called The Reason for Wings, and saying, even though you haven't published a new novel, first novel, I think this so fits into that group of your books that you're doing. And he agreed. And so we co-published that. And then he moved on to Wisconsin, and another manuscript came my way, and we wound up publishing three books together. So my responsibility was the editing, design, and providing them. And I work with a wonderful designer all these years, Sandy Rogers, who's a very dear friend. And I worked with at the University of Maryland. I was in a program where I was writing about Chesapeake Bay science. I'd left teaching. And we co-published three books there, and Wisconsin distributed a couple of just dryer press books. And that was a terrific arrangement. And so my investment was the money that I paid Sandy. I wasn't charging for my time. So that could come out of my pocket. And, you know, that might be $1,500 at the time, you know, between Sandy and ancillary costs. And, a couple of those books sold. So that brought in, some more money that went to the next book. You know, not a lot because we were splitting things and I didn't get, it wasn't a half and half arrangement. You know, we might have gotten, I don't even remember, 25% of the net. And as you know, the amount of money that a publisher gets after all the discounts from the distributor and so forth, returns and all of that. But that's, you know, that was another way I financed. In a couple of cases, poets helped me, you know, publish the book. You know, I don't think of this as vanity at all. It was really helping out, and, you know, money came back in. You know, they got their, you know, their investment back. So it's really been a combination. And then sales, just recently, this latest book, although the new book is just back from the printer, that I'm now co-publishing again with this book with Robert Mandel, although he has an independent press. He retired, and it's Mandel Vilar Press. And we've had the same arrangement where I've done the editing, the book, which was just delivered 2 days ago. Beautiful book. And but in this case, we're splitting things down the middle, half and half.
And how are your books distributed now?
Well, now they've been distributed by Small Press Distribution. Yeah. And, you know, that distributes, as you know, and maybe some of your listeners know, probably a couple hundred presses, maybe more. You know, they've done some things proactively. They do. They have a monthly handpicked. Well, they'll select four books. I mean, the publisher goes in and pays a couple of $100, and they do a special promotion on that. And the publisher has to apply. Well, we did it with this last book, and so is The Bus, which got a fabulous Kirkus review. And you know, they sold, you know, not great sales, but, you know, like 100, 150 copies. And so, you know, you try to get, you know, reviews, library reviews particularly, and bloggers who are interested. It's a little bit difficult when you have a writer who is no longer living, and the author, Yossel Beirstein, has been, you know, died in the late 80s, and his translator, primary translator, live in Israel. So it's not been easy getting, you know, say, you know, any programs going for that book.
Translation is something I noticed that you've done more than the average smaller publisher. Most literary publishers are, you know, are either, you know, they're just maybe not knowledgeable or they stay away from translation, but you seem to have embraced it.
Yeah, and I'm monolingual, by the way. I mean, I've studied different languages, and so I can read Hebrew. I've worked with Moshe Dor, several books that I've worked with Moshe that Dryad Press has published. And I've worked with Moshe. Moshe sadly died this spring. He had a great facility for English. And, so I can read Hebrew. I can read Russian. I wouldn't begin to translate it, but the text that we do, except for an anthology, I've definitely want to have the original language side by side. So one of the books that I co-published with Wisconsin, book of poetry by Rani Somek from Israel, that Moshe Dor and Barbara Goldberg translated, it's bilingual. A book that we're going to be publishing at the beginning of 2018, the poetry and prose of Elena Schwartz. The poetry will be on facing pages, you know, with the Russian on one, you know, on the left side and the English on the right. The prose will not be bilingual. Even a book of Macedonian poetry, which Charles Simic translated, we have the Macedonian facing the English.
I take it you're not a reader of Macedonian, however.
No, I'm not. I wouldn't pretend. I can't even say I'm a reader. I mean, I can read. I've studied Russian at different times, so when I say I can read it, but in working with Thomas Epstein, who is the editor and translator for the Elena Schwartz, you know, we've been working. So I've been reviving my, you know, my Russian again. As I say, I can read it. I wouldn't read it out loud, but certainly eye reading, and even working on a Polish some Polish poem. I can't read Polish, but you know, when you have the English side by side, and I can read the Cyrillic, so that's the important thing.
Right.
You can get a feel, at the very least, you can get a feel for line lengths, repetitions, sounds.
No, I think it's...
In fact,
you almost could argue there's a literary value to reading a poem in a language you don't understand if you can at least hear it. You know, you can at least gather the sound of the words. I think you could argue there's some significant literary value there.
No, I think there is. This summer, we've been renting houses up in a small village in northern Vermont in Craftsbury Common. And one of my things that I had this summer was to begin listening to Dante, to the Inferno.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I had bilingual edition, but you can get the Italian on YouTube or audio, and just to be able to hear the soundings of that. I mean, I could see it on the page.
One of my favorite classes in college was Dante, Petrarch, and Boccaccio, and it was a graduate level course that I could not understand. I mean, you know, all of the other students in the class read Italian except for me, but it was still incredible. It was like just the language is so beautiful.
Yeah, well, you know, I have three granddaughters, and my daughter-in-law, her mother is German, and our oldest son, Jeremy, who, their father, lived in Germany for 2 years and became fluent. He has a very good ear. So these girls have grown up with German in the house. You know, so I think if there's one envy, and I think it's really the envy that I have, is having that natural, you know, growing up with this second language.
Yeah.
And then one of the girls has been in French immersion since the beginning, so she's trilingual. I mean, in Europe, this is no big deal, but here, in certain parts of the country, we get upset if, you know, if younger people are speaking, Spanish.
That's true. Well, it's a provincial. We are provincial.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit more about, I mean, one of the things I noticed, and I found this piece that you did online, which I thought was really interesting. You gave a talk to the AGL Capital Area Chapter where you received an award, and you talked about kind of realizing that you were publishing lots of Jewish books, even though you don't identify the press, Dryad is not really focused on Jewish themes, but, you know, and you're not a Jewish publisher, but you have done a lot of books that are really deeply Jewish.
Yeah, well, I have. But, you know, first of all, the award, which was very nice, was through it was at the national meeting, but it was through the Washington chapter. So in the talk that I gave there, first of all, surprise! You know, I thought it was going to be a small award, community service. Well, it turned out they had commissioned this woodcut, a paper cut, a beautiful large paper cut, detailed, which was commissioned and was related to, you know, the books naturally, but the work I've done and a book that I published called, you know, Mark the Music. And so, I began to speak to say, first of all, that I'm certainly very much appreciative of the award, but I'm not a Jewish publisher. Jewish interests, yes. The text, I love texts. I've quoted or referred to George Steiner in a couple of places in which he was asked, well, what is the home of the Jews? And he said, the home of the Jews is the text. Hmm. You know, it's like a snail carries its shell on its back. The Jew carries the text on its back. And I think that's the kind of Jewish, you know, the Jew that I am. George Steiner also had another wonderful little remark. He said, a Jew is someone who reads a book with a pencil in hand. And I cannot, you know, reading is study. Doesn't mean I don't read non-literary books. But, you know, each, I guess for me, it's study. And so the Bible, the Torah and Hasidic texts. And then over these years, at different times, I've strongly immersed myself in the poetry and literature of the golden age of Hebrew poetry in Spain from around the 11th century to the 14th century. I mean, it was an incredible period of, you know, of literary production by, you know, the Arab culture, which provided the models for the wonderful poetry of wine, women, and song, believe it or not. And these were rabbis who were writing. And the influence of the Arabic culture that really rescued the great classical texts and were translating them during the so-called Dark Ages of Europe. It wasn't dark in what we call Spain. I mean, it wasn't called Spain then. It was Sephara, at least the Hebrews called it. So, yeah, I've been immersed in different aspects of Jewish texts, but for their literary importance to me, and maybe themes. So there are allusions. I think, and I realized I hadn't been aware of it until we started putting up this website, the number of Jewish works that I was, works that I was involved in publishing.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly clear. And I know you also recently did this book that, is a Yiddish writer that you're.
Yes. Blumel Lempel.
Yes.
This is an extraordinary. Blumel Lempel, who was fluent in English, she came to this country. She was very fortunate. She and her husband were able to get. She was from a small village in Poland. Had gone to Paris, where her brother was living, and loved Paris and planned on living there. And then the war came, the war hadn't come yet, and they were able to get out of France and came to the United States and. And she had a family, and she wrote stories, and she wrote a novel, but they were all Yiddish. And she even went to the new school in New York. So it's not that she couldn't write in English, but she chose to stay with her mama loshen, the mother language, and was a very nuanced writer. This book is called Oedipus in Brooklyn and Other Stories, and the writing is so nuanced, the psychological aspects, and the translators, Ellen Cassidy and Yirmiyahu Aaron Taub, I think have done just a remarkable work. In fact, the book won the Yiddish Book Center's 2012 Translation Award. If you didn't know that these stories were translated from the Yiddish, you would read them as a modernist literature.
There's this, I thought about that when I saw that book, because there is that, I don't think it's well known enough. You know, Yiddish is sort of looked at as even among people who celebrate the language, it's thought of as, a kind of slang, a home language, not necessarily recognized as literary, but also as part of the kind of modernist movement of the 20s and 30s. In Europe in particular, there was a really, I just recently read a book about a woman in Poland during World War II, a Catholic woman who rescued 2,500 Jewish children. And one of the things that struck me was the advanced literary culture that she lived in Warsaw in the 30s, that we just don't see it. It's just not visible to us how, what Europe was like in that period. It's just not known enough, I think.
Yeah. Well, even in the United States, there were Jewish, Yiddish poets who were fluent in English. Probably the most well-known was Jacob Gladstein. These poets, Manny Leib, Jacob Gladstein, they knew, they were reading Pound, they were reading Eliot,
right.
They were up on modernist literature.
Right.
They were
part of the modernist movement.
Yeah, something so interesting, and again, as you say, we don't realize it. They had an audience not only here because there was such a large, educated, besides an immigrant population that was not educated, from these Eastern Polish, lands, in the Soviet Union and before the Soviet Union in Russia, but there was an intelligentsia and the Yiddish literature, where Sholem Aleichem came out of and Peretz. This was a high literature, and even more so, and the work was the writers who were living in America, their work was being read in Europe, because there were these, as you know, I'm repeating what you know, these flourishing communities in Lviv, in various places in Warsaw, and so they were reading American poets. Who were writing in Yiddish. I have on my desk right here a wonderful writer, Yitzhak Munger. His poems were read widely there, and he lived here.
Do you think I'm sure this has been written about by scholars, but I wonder, there is the kind of general sensibility in America that when immigrants come to America, there are two different tracks. One is people gather together and maintain the original language community, and then others say, "I'm not going to speak my home language anymore. I'm giving it up. I'm going to become all American." And those two different tendencies, I think, have existed in almost every immigrant culture.
Certainly here. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, it's all right. I just wondered if, anybody has, if that's been studied, the kind of differentiation, like what kind of people keep to the original language, or maybe what you've described in Yiddish writers as something actually different in a way, because they've chose to continue the literary tradition of their of the mother tongue, even though they could have written in the adopted English language.
Right. Well, who knows what would have happened in that if we didn't have that catastrophe, in Europe. But there were these, again, there were these flourishing Yiddish communities. But I could use my own family as an example. My mother, who was the youngest of seven, so she was only a few years old, but I had aunts who were teenagers. It took me until I was early in college to realize that English wasn't their second language. That was a second language. They were so intent. I had spoken with an aunt of mine later on about all of this, how intent they were to learn English. And so Yiddish was the secret of language.
Right.
They would speak Yiddish, but we weren't to learn Yiddish, right? Of course, you started to learn because you heard it so much. On the other hand, a very dear friend of mine, Dorothy Billick, who did a good deal of scholarship, taught Yiddish language and Yiddish literature in the German department at the University of Maryland. We were older graduate students together at Maryland. And she grew up in a family that they very much spoke only Yiddish in the house. They were Bundist, you know, they were, you know, political, and, you know, there were Yiddish day schools then. You know, and I'm not looking back in any nostalgic way. Who knows if it would have continued even if there hadn't been, you know, the Shoah or the Holocaust in Europe. But there was always that audience there, and it was a literary audience, a literary readership. With all the millions who were killed, it was those communities, that communalism that was destroyed as well. And who could ever measure the costs of, I shouldn't say cost, it's a poor metaphor. It's staggering to that, right. You know, this thousand-year culture that had been developing, because the Jews started moving, from the Rhine and from the west to the east back 1,000 years before.
Yeah. Well, so to go back to Dryad, I know we've been sort of, I mean, this is an interesting subject, but I do want to kind of go back and just ask a couple more questions of you about Dryad, and kind of triggered by this. Do you feel, I mean, you know, I think of literary magazines and presses as being part of literary communities, and sometimes being at the forefront of a community or reflecting, documenting in many different, you know, they work different ways. And sometimes are simply reflective of the editorial view of the editor. So there's no one thing about any literary magazine that we could say is the way all of them work. But for you, has Dryad, what has Dryad meant in terms of literary culture and community? Have you felt that as something important, as what important part of what you do, or is it kind of a secondary thing for you?
Yeah, it's not that there's a complicated answer to this. I've been very involved in literary affairs in Washington. And that probably was the result of my publishing, you know, Dryad and Dryad Press. But I think the press, and I'm not speaking about myself here, David, I think that the press may be different than a lot of other literary presses, because it is the result of my own, I won't say whims, but literary interests that range and opportunities that come, that present themselves, manuscripts that come my way. And so the mix of nonfiction and fiction and poetry, which I had no idea 20 years ago I would be doing, it really followed, my ranging interest, ranging interests. I was at a retreat this past week, as I think I may have told you. It was a writer's retreat. There were only 25 people. It was purposely kept small, and it was like a day and a half or 2 days of immersion in literature with workshops. And I was giving the closing talk, and the talk had to do with different ways of, non-mimetic ways of making poems, coming at things slant, as Emily Dickinson has, and other, what we would call, I don't even know if they're experimental at all. But I also brought along, almost at the last minute, I put a bunch of different kinds of Dryad books in the box and had them displayed, and just said something. This is the kind of involvements I've had, but it's been part of my writing and part of my study. I don't think I could publish books if I wasn't writing. I see it as an extension in a way of what I do. I mean, I love the making of books, and I love the collaboration I've had with writers. And I'm not sure I'm really answering your question. I don't know that I'm leading any kind of cultural thing here in Washington at all. I guess Dryad has a reputation because I've been around for so long. And I'm really, while I'm connected to a literary communities here, there's no one community. Washington is has numbers of different presses, numbers of different movements, and I'm an older guy now, But I guess I keep my eye out for different kinds of things. So I've also published some things you haven't seen. I used to think that I was pretty conventional, and maybe I am. But I remember when we went to the first literary conference, which I mentioned right at the beginning of this, the keynote speaker was George Hitchcock, who published that great magazine Kayak out of California.
Yeah, I remember
him. And wonderful magazines, and not just the fact that he was printing them himself, but he was bringing some of at that time new writers, Charles Simic and Robert Bly was at the beginning of their career, of his career. He hadn't really made any big thing yet, and so many writers, and he was publishing books. Well, at any rate, the one thing I remember of George addressing us all, almost an accusatory way of not being adventurous, like him, so to speak. And it was really such a high to go to that gathering, because it was the first time I got together with other literary, magazine editors. Mm-hmm. It was just great. And I haven't done that sort of thing. I haven't been going to AWP meetings. For me, it's just been a too much to handle, although the next one is going to be here in Washington, and I think Robert Mandel and I are going to share it. Mandel, Vilar Press are going to share a table, but I haven't done that. But I realize when I look back at some of these issues, and not in any nostalgic way, I've done some unconventional things. When I was at Oxford for the 3 years, I met a mathematician in the, we all got together at different times at the Graduate Common Room, and he had an interest in poetry, and he had developed a little program for composing poems using a computer. So this is in 1971. And I said, wow, that sounds great. I said, maybe we can do some of these. And I did. He wrote a little essay about that, and we printed the computer printout at that time, Carl Bodie, who was at Maryland, did these poems of silence, and there was hardly anything on the page. And, I thought those were intriguing. And I said, the only thing I ask of you, Carl, is that you have to write something to go along with this. I don't know. I'm not sure what I'm getting at here.
No, I think you've actually covered some interesting ground, I think, that, it's sort of, it is related to my question, so don't worry about that.
I want to say one last thing, if I have time, just one last thing.
Yeah.
There's a poem that it's among, the 1,000 great poems, I think, Tennyson's Ulysses. And if you remember, Tennyson has Ulysses speak. It's a dramatic monologue. And it's a longish poem in which this is Ulysses in old age. So he takes Ulysses not from Homer, but from Dante, who consigned Odysseus or Ulysses to hell, in one of the rungs of hell. And in old age, Ulysses is dissatisfied. He says, I meet and dole unequal laws unto a savage race that know not me.
Mm.
And he feels a claustrophobia, and he's decided that he's going to leave, and he's going to give the reign of the Isle of Ithaca over to his son Telemachus. He says, he has his work, I have mine. And what is his work? To gather his men and to go sailing far beyond, to go beyond the utmost bounds of human thought. And the famous last lines, to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield. And it's continually exploring, continually venturing out. And that's tough to do, as we know. The older you get, even when you're younger, you can be old when you're young, is to keep trying to venture out. We need boundaries. And as James Hillman says in Revisioning Psychology, you need to break them up and to leave them behind if soul making is to continue. And at least it's a nice aesthetic. Whether I actually do it or not is another thing.
Well, you actually led me to write to the question I was thinking about asking you anyway, and that is, you've been doing this for a really long time. Do you have a sense that, like, you'll just keep on doing it until you're tired of doing it, or do you have a sense that well, I should, you know, I'm going to just stop. You know, I mean, I'm just curious what, like, how you feel about that.
Well, I thought that I was stopping at different times, but I don't know if you've seen this little Dryad catalog, Tress catalog. Yeah, I promised books and have committed myself to doing some books, you know, smaller chapbooks, but also larger books. This big book of Elena Schwartz is going to be a very large book because of the, you know, just in the number of pages, but in the prose, and Tom Epstein was doing, you know, giving me the translations of the prose this summer, and then I was going back with him, you know, reading them, you know, giving him back, you know, my reactions, and then I'm doing this book. You know, before we started speaking, I was going through editing a memoir by a man who was the president of Sterling College, and I would, you know, I had no intention of publishing this book. In fact, I think we're going to co-publish it. I think Robert Mandel will be interested in this. I've spoken to him about this, but this is a memoir about being in higher administration of very small colleges, Marlborough, which has got 300 some odd students, and Sterling, which has at maximum 125. But you know, and the subject matter itself didn't have an intrinsic interest for me. But when Will asked me to just, you know, give him some thoughts on a few chapters, I loved his sentences. I loved the writing. And so he's now in the third revision where he's gotten, you know, he needed to tell more of a story. And so he's in this more, he was a hockey player and he was, you know, he's a fly fisherman and he worked on his father's ranch and his father was the editor of Life magazine. And so there are these, and he and his wife had a cut for 12 years, a cut garden nursery. So it all become, you know, so it's gotten melded in, not melded in, but it's telling a larger story, but it's the writing. I love the writing.
Well, I can,
so,
you know,
yeah, I don't know. Will I continue going? Yeah, I guess again, if I wasn't writing myself, I, you know, this will sound very strange since I've been doing books for so long, but I mean this, if I say it will sound funny, but I never really thought of myself as a publisher. When my friend Herman Taub, who I published several of his books, Herman died 2 years ago at 96. Herman would introduce me as his publisher. I would kind of squinch up a little bit because I didn't think of myself in that way. I made books. I loved making books, but I just didn't think of myself as a publisher. So, you know, in this book, for example, that we've just done, that's Oedipus in Brooklyn, you know, co-publishing with Robert Mandel. So we're going through his distribution outfit, which is distributed by Consortium, and they have sales reps, and there have been back orders, unheard of now for me, back orders for the book, because he pitched the book to the sales reps in one of their national meetings. And there was a lot of interest in it. But in the last book, And So Is the Bus, and so we had to be very careful on the margins because, you know, so much is taken out, you know, with distribution costs and advertising and everything else. But on So Is the Bus, I could, because it was my, you know, the book that I was doing, I could choose to have those signatures sewn and not perfect bound. So sure, it was costing me another 20, you know, 25 or 30 cents a book, but those decisions.
What comes across, and I love that, is, you know, how much you love the writing. And I think that's really an important element. You know, I think that it's almost, it would seem obvious, but hearing it in your voice, I think, is really valuable. You know, it's sort of, I'm not sure that everyone realizes how much goes into and how much work and difficulty and struggle and effort goes into making books, those who haven't done it. But so for those who do, it's always got to be motivated by some, you know, something bigger. And
it's certainly not the money.
That is true. Well, it's I love talking to you. I love listening to you tell stories about your work, and I appreciate your taking some time to talk to me about Dryad for this series, which is really kind of meant to be just a kind of oral history of independent publishing of the last 50 years. And I think Dryad is a wonderful example of what people have been, you know, what some people have done. And you are, you know, what you have done is really special. So I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, David.
Thanks, Merrill. This has been Publishing Talks. I've been talking to Merrill Loeffler about Dryad Press, principally, and a little bit about Dryad Magazine. This is David Wilk, your host. Thank you very much.